And so I think we feel like us today about the whole figure in the broader framework of climate change.
Thank you for your hospitality. Nice lunch. I'm sorry for starting a little late and got carried away talking with soup. So I want to bring together two different pieces of science. One is about the what happens to fossil fuel CO2 after we release it to the atmosphere on sort of long time scales. And then the other is a mechanism for an interglacial climate such as ours going into a glacial climate, so the beginning of the next ice age. And I'll show you how those two fit together by the time we get to the end. So I had a quick look through the Perimeter Institute book, and I saw all the things that you all are doing, and I hope that you will stop me and ask questions if I don't make any sense. If you were to come to my department, we would ask you questions too, no doubt, if you didn't make any sense. So the first topic is the fate of fossil fuel CO2. After we release CO2 into the atmosphere, it slowly goes away by sort of invading other parts of the Earth system, and the different places where it can go take up carbon dioxide on very different timescales. So the bulk of what we release will eventually dissolve in the oceans. There's a lot of dissolved CO2 in the oceans. Oceans have the same sort of carbonate chemistry as we have in our blood. And the ocean holds like 50 times more carbon than the atmosphere does, so it's a huge reservoir of carbon. And that takes several centuries for to happen. Actually, 50 years ago, anybody who thought about it probably figured that the atmosphere would totally control the CO2 concentration of the atmosphere instantaneously, and that it would be impossible for mankind to make a difference in the CO2. Because, you know, it's a blue planet after all. 70% of the Earth's surface is covered by oceans, and so you'd think it would be fast. But as it turns out, the way the ocean circulates, the deep parts of the ocean are very cold water, and that only sees the atmosphere at a few places in the high latitudes and a few sort of short windows of time every year. And so it takes a long time to equilibrate those two reservoirs. The terrestrial biosphere gives up carbon when we cut down trees and burn them, or it takes up carbon if we let forests grow. And that has a time scale of centuries. And then on longer time scales, there are reactions with rocks. So calcium carbonate is chemically, it's a base, and it reacts with CO2, which is an acid, to form bicarbonate, which is the main form of carbon in the ocean. And so that takes sort of thousands of years. And then ultimately, there's this another set of weathering reactions with igneous rocks, which contain calcium oxide. And that, when that dissolves, you have to take CO2 out of the air to make a calcium carbonate. So the calcium oxide, CaO, turns into CaCO3 in the bottom of the ocean eventually. And so that is responsible for dealing with carbon on timescales of hundreds of thousands of years. So if we look at the CO2 concentration of the atmosphere on time scale of 40,000 years into the future, we see this spike here, which is us, and the CO2 goes up as we release it, and then it comes back down mostly, about 3/4 of it, on a time scale of hundreds of years as it dissolves in the ocean. And this is pretty much what people talk about when they talk about the lifespan of global warming, is a few hundred years. But my point in my talk tonight in particular, and the book I'm working on now, is that there's this long tail to the whole thing that lasts for thousands of years, or even hundreds of thousands of years. So a quarter of the CO2 is there for thousands of years. Fill up a tank of gas, 3 gallons of it will be affecting the climate for thousands of years. And this, the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which is this organization of climate scientists who write these reports every 5 years or so and put them out. They're sort of the scientific underpinning for the Kyoto kind of negotiation. They got this wrong from going from a technical chapter, which knew all about the long time scale, to the summary report. There's this table. Table 1 has the atmospheric lifetime of carbon dioxide is 5 to 200 years. which again is just that spike, which is most of the story, but not all of it. The thing is that once it's wrong in the IPCC, this is sort of gospel and there's just no way. So it appears everywhere now. All the popular books about global warming say, gosh, the CO2 will stay in the atmosphere for a century or up to 200 years, the economists said, you know, looking at that table. And it just totally misses that long tail. So, you know, there are books that talk about ways of engineering the climate back to a cooler climate. If it turns out that warming is truly disastrous, you could put smoke up in the stratosphere or something. You could imagine doing that for 100 years, but 100,000 years, that's a little tall. So it's not a controversial result that the CO2 has this long tail. I first published on this in 97, and I did it again in 2005, and I wasn't even the first, and there have been a lot of papers that have been done just recently. I think this is all of them. I'm not leaving any of them out. They all show during the peak, the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere is like 50 to 70% of the total slug that's released. You know, it depends on the timing of if you released it all at once, it would all be in the atmosphere, you know, the minute after you released it. But given the sort of multiple century time scale of releasing it, that's sort of what it does in the peak. And then after 1,000 years, you still have 30, 40, 50% in the atmosphere. And 10,000 years, you still have a large amount. I mean, there are differences. These models are all very different from each other. But this is pretty, I call this agreement. Okay, so that was ingredient number one.
This is the story. Yes. If you stop releasing CO2 in the atmosphere today, there would still be a tail that would live on for thousands of years.
That's true, yes.
And the problem is mostly that we're actually continuing to release it.
Yeah. Yeah. So at present, the ocean is taking up carbon at about half the rate that we are releasing it. That's because there's more carbon in the atmosphere than would be sort of in the natural equilibrium between the atmosphere and the ocean. So the disequilibrium is driving the flux into the ocean. So if we were to cut our emissions today by about half, then what we emitted would be balanced by the ocean uptake for a while until the ocean started to saturate and fill up. But that's what it would take to stop the CO2 from rising. Yes?
Does increasing the level in the ocean have an effect on the things that live in the ocean?
So CO2 is an acid, and acid is hard on organisms like corals that create calcium carbonate. So, you know, if you pour vinegar on the limestone steps, it'll bubble, the same sort of thing. Corals are also being hit by rising temperatures, though, and by, you know, increasing turbidity from runoff and stuff like that. So they're getting hit all different ways. But, yeah, there was an example in the past, 55 million years ago, where there was some release of CO2. I'll show it in a couple. No, I won't. I'll show it tonight. I could dig it up, actually. But where there was a big release of CO2 and a warming, the warming and the CO2 both persisted for order 100,000 years. And there was this sort of scour layer in the sediment where there was no calcium carbonate. And there were extinctions of organisms that produced calcium carbonate at that time. It's called ocean acidification. It's like the other problem with CO2. It's, you know, a secondary problem for sure. Yeah.
There's also a report on the dead zone, it's low in the oceans.
Yeah, that has to do with oxygen, actually, more than with carbon dioxide. So that's from fertilizers from agriculture that fertilize the phytoplankton to grow on the surface. And then they sink down and they decay and use up the oxygen down below. So you get this big blob of anoxic water that comes up on the shelf every so often. And kills all the shellfish that you're fishing for and everything. The Gulf of Mexico is kind of the main, a big place where that happens, but it also happens on the west coast of the U.S. also. Okay, so the second ingredient is orbital variations of the Earth and climate. And so the orbit of the Earth undergoes these sort of periodic variations that affect not so much the total amount of sunlight that the Earth receives if you integrate it over the surface of the Earth and over the whole year, but it has a huge effect on the distribution of the energy, where and when you get the solar energy. So one of the, you may have heard this before, one of the ingredients is the eccentricity of the orbit. There are times when the orbit is nearly circular. Actually, we're in such time now. Other times when it's more elliptical. the axis of rotation isn't perpendicular to the plane of the orbit. It's tilted a little bit, and how much it's tilted, the obliquity of the tilt varies between about 22 and 25 degrees. And then also, given that the Earth, the axis is tilted, you know, you get the northern hemisphere summer when the northern hemisphere is tilted toward the Earth. I guess they gave an exam to Harvard students, and the Harvard students thought that you got summer when you were close to the Earth, and that's close to the sun. That's not true. It's when the tilt is toward. So the northern hemisphere summer could be here, in which case it would be a cool summer, or the northern hemisphere summer could be here, in which case it would be a warm summer. So as the axis of rotation processes like a top, and as it does that, it affects the distribution of sunlight on the Earth. Of course, if the Earth's orbit is circular, then it doesn't make any difference, the precession. It makes most difference when the orbit is most elliptical. So here's actually a scale picture of the orbit to show you, you know, how big the changes are. It's not a huge difference. And then here is the sunlight. It turns out that the thing that triggers an ice age is the summertime sunlight at 65 degrees north. It's in the northern hemisphere rather than the southern hemisphere, because that's where the land is to put ice sheets. And it's in the summer rather than the winter, because it's always cold enough to snow in the winter, but the question is whether it's cool enough in the summer that you can keep the snow from last winter and accumulate it again for next winter. So this is now looking at the watts per meter squared at 65 north as a function of the time of year, and you see that the different orbital configurations vary the seasonal cycle of the sunlight there. So the eccentricity of the Earth, here is zero eccentricity, and then 0.06, so it's still 94% circular, and it has this sort of a trajectory through time. So there's this larger sort of 400,000-year cycle, and then there's also this 100,000-year thing too. And so you can see the spectrum of the eccentricity here. There's a 400,000-year component, and then these sort of 100,000-year pieces of it there.
How do you measure this?
They were originally calculated by a guy named Milankovitch. My understanding was that he was in jail when he was doing it. This was like in the 30s or something like that. And he was doing this with pencil and paper. I've always wondered this. It'd be great to have some sort of a tool that I could use to teach, you know, with, that where all this sort of made sense, more than just kind of you integrate the orbit of the position of the Earth around the sun a million times. I don't know. I mean, I think the way they actually do these calculations is with, you know, codes that actually do exactly that.
It was a calculation.
Yes, a calculation. Yes. The obliquity, which is the tilt, has a period of about 40,000 years, and it affects mostly the sunlight at the poles. At the equator, it doesn't have much of an impact. And then this is an interesting factoid about the obliquity. It's stabilized. The obliquity of the Earth's orbit is stabilized by the presence of the moon. Mars doesn't have a massive moon like we have, and so Mars tilts all the way over and back. It's just wild. And this was one of these models of the orbit, and they just turned off the moon at time zero here. And so you see what happens after that. It's an amazing thing. Apropos of absolutely nothing, we're not worried about losing the moon, but just I thought you might enjoy that. And then the third component is the precessional cycle, which is the spinning like a top, which has time scales of sort of 20,000 years or so. And you see that the variability that the precession has on the sunlight intensities here depends on the circularity of the orbit. So today, the Earth's orbit is nearly circular, and so the precession doesn't have much much legs, whereas, you know, half a cycle ago, the precession had a much stronger impact on the solar force. And that'll be important, actually, at the end. So now going from this orbital forcing, which affects the sunlight at 65 degrees north in the summer, to the actual ice volume, they think it's the 65 degree north in the summer because if you do a spectral decomposition of the ice volume curve, which is this, and line up the 20,000 year wiggles from the precessional forcing, that's what works. But there are problems in that the precessional forcing has a lot more of the 20 and a bit more of the 40,000 year forcing in it than the ice volume does, which looks mostly like sort of 100,000 years. So it's not just a simple forcing, you know, a simple linear response to this forcing. There's stuff going on beyond that. And so if you take the spectrum of the ice volume, so here's the ice volume. If you look at the spectrum of it, you see precessional peaks, and here's an obliquity peak. But what you mostly see for the most recent part of the geologic record is this 100,000 year energy here, sort of this boom, 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 right there.
In the previous slide, I didn't understand the blue and the red curves. What were we seeing there?
That is actually, it's just to demonstrate how sensitive. So what we're talking about is lining up the timings of these orbital changes versus when the Earth goes into an ice age. And this is just to show that the timings of these peaks are sensitive to when exactly you think when and where exactly you think the sweet spot is for changing the climate. So this is just 65 north for both of them, but one of them is July, the red one, and blue is June. So there's a lot of room for tuning this to to fudge the answer a little bit.
And then so those are both orbital things, and you're comparing that to the bottom one, which is what the ice is doing.
Yeah. So it's sort of like a side point there.
So is that experimental data on the ice volumes down at the bottom?
Yeah. So when you make an ice sheet, it preferentially takes the lighter isotope of oxygen in the water, the oxygen 16. Because it's like a giant still. You evaporate some in the low latitudes, and all the heavy stuff rains out and rains out and rains out. And when you finally get up to where you make an ice sheet, that water has been so heavily distilled that it's very, very enriched in oxygen 16. So it's very depleted in oxygen 18. And as a result, the oxygen 18 of the whole ocean that's left behind co-varies with the size of the ice sheet. And so this is labeled as ice volume, but the data actually come from the oxygen 18 and calcium carbonate shells in sediment cores, which tell us how big the ice sheets were. So when trying to go from this orbital forcing signal to the ice sheets, the precession and the obliquity both seem like they work okay. So here is the oxygen 18, which is the ice sheets, and it's been filtered so that it only has the time period of the precession in it, and all the rest is thrown out. And you know, if you take off your glasses, I guess you can kind of see that where the envelope is big here in the precession, the variations are big in the ice volume, and then here, the same thing is done with the obliquity, and it seems like it sort of works. So it seems like it's a more or less linear system insofar as it responds at these frequencies, or at least that's a conclusion that many. I'm not a mathematician, so you know, don't. But this is sort of how it's.
There seem to be objective correlations, not possible.
Well, let's put it this way. This looks better than it will when you start looking at the longer time frame. So, you know, it's as good as it gets. It's not, you know, I can't do much better. The 100,000 year, if we compare here, the solid line is the eccentricity, and then the dashed line is the ice volume filtered by 100,000 years. On the face of it, that doesn't look too bad. But what they've had to do that is throw out the 400,000 year part, which, if you're just doing it, you know, like a signal processor, that doesn't sound so, I mean, just it's sort of abstract. You can get away with chopping out something. But if you actually look at what the eccentricity looks like, it's saying that this point right here has more in common with that point than this point and that point would have. In other words, that being at a local high is all important, and then the absolute value of the eccentricity of the orbit has no implication. And there's no theoretical reason, you know, to throw out the longer time period. Yeah.
Do we know that the energy output from the sun is stable over these time scales? Stable enough to ignore.
Well, there are a couple of ways in which the solar output varies. One is there's a slight variation on the sunspot cycle, sort of 11-year cycle.
That's
fairly small. There is a secular increase in the luminosity of the sun over geologic time. So the sun now is brighter. It puts out 25% or so more energy than it did when the Earth was new.
You mean millions of years?
Billions of years. 4.5 billion years.
Do we know that on time scales of 100,000 years there isn't some other oscillations or process?
And there's also the issue of passing through the arms of the galactic plane through clouds of dust that will block or transmit more of the sun's radiation to the Earth. So that's another issue, which is sort of effectively the same as questioning the output of the sun.
Yeah, that's right.
How much of a fraction of that dust change, I mean, directly, what percentage of change is that?
I can't tell you that. There's also a question about the orbit of the Earth relative to the plane of the ecliptic. The idea that there might be more dust right in the ecliptic. And so sometimes the orbit is, you know, steers clear of that, and other times it stays in. I don't think either of these ideas have come to fruition in terms of an alternate, in terms of a theory of evolution of climate, but I can't really defend, you know, that they're not. I think there's.
I'm trying to believe it would be as big as a percent or something, whereas with the orbit, eccentricity is like a percentage effect, right? It's like 1 or 2% effect.
Well, the way the eccentricity affects the insulation is strictly by dialing up and down the precession. So the eccentricity itself doesn't have a huge impact on, very small impact on the total amount of energy that the Earth receives, but not nearly so profound an impact as just by enabling the precession. So if we're willing to throw out the 400,000 year cycle for no particular good reason, we still have a problem that the 100,000-year cycle that we have left is much weaker in the orbital forcing than in the evolution of climate. So we need some sort of an amplifier, a low-pass filter or something that could generate could amplify the 100,000-year forcing. And so and then there's another piece to this puzzle here, which is that these different frequencies of climate response seem to arise independently. So this is now a history of the ice volume through the last 3 million years, years today. And there was an earlier part to this ice age where the ice volume was had a fairly regular 40,000 year rhythm. And then there was this time called the mid-Pleistocene transition where you sort of changed, and now what we've been looking at so far was just this part, which has got the 100,000-year cycle. So any theory to sort of explain all of this has to has to come up with, you know, why the 100,000-year cycle should have turned on, you know, just lately. And I'm not going to explain this for you today. I'm just sort of giving you a lay of the land of where we are in the field. So an early model for how to grow and melt ice sheets based on the orbital forcing just had some sort of orbital forcing here and an offset, and then a rate constant, and they used different rate constants for growing and for decaying the ice, which makes sense. It takes longer to grow an ice sheet probably than it does to melt it. And that nonlinearity in those rate constants generates some 100,000-year power by sort of amplifying, I guess, or modulating the faster cycles. So here is a spectrum of the real ice data. You see the 100,000-year dominates over the 40 and the 20s. And then here is the spectrum of what you get from that early model. And it, you know, it strives to get a little bit of the 100,000-year, but it doesn't really quite get it. Another model essentially relaxed the ice volume to some forcing, to the forcing, and it had different values for the constants for melting and growing. And with this one, it managed to get more of a boost in the low end. So you see 100,000 years forcing cycle in the ice that's sort of comparable to that of the faster ones. But now it's running into this problem that it's getting the 400,000-year forcing as well, which isn't there in the data. So there's not really a 400,000-year cycle in the data. So the model that I like is actually based on thresholds, the idea that the climate sort of can exist in some state, and then if some threshold is crossed, it can flip into some other state. And so the way that they drew this was here was an interglacial state, and then if the sunlight intensity in the northern hemisphere summer drops below some critical value, you drop off into a glacial state, so you nucleate an ice sheet. And then the climate sort of whacks around in this glacial state for a time until the volume of the ice sheet gets big enough that it can melt. The way an ice sheet flows is it depends on the lubrication at the bed. If it's warm enough to be melted at the bed, the ice can flow fairly quickly. But if the ice is frozen to the bed, it won't flow at all. So you nucleate this ice sheet, and then you wait around until the ice gets big enough to flow, and that puts you into state number three, this big glacial state. And then if it gets warm enough in the northern hemisphere summer, then you plop back to this first state. So again, I mean, I'm drawing the same thing again. Interglacial state, below some critical insulation value, you go to a glacial state, so you nucleate the ice sheet. And then when the volume of the ice exceeds some critical amount where the ice sheet purges, then you go to an unstable glacial state. And then as soon as the ice exceeds some different threshold, you go back here. And so here's an evolution of these climate states. So here is our interglacial time in the real ice core, ice sheet data. And here is Payerd's interglacial state. And he makes the case that he captures these deglaciation events fairly well with this sort of threshold model.
The ice sheet gets big enough that it starts to slide off the continents and break apart. But then it's not entirely obvious to me that that's anything other than just saying, well, the ice just slides around.
Well, it's a hand baby model. I mean, it's just a little sort of a toy model, and the part about you know, the ice sheet has to grow to a certain size before it can collapse. That's, you know, the most hand-wavy part of it. Actually, the whole reason, the part of it that I'm going to use in this talk is just the part where we nucleate the ice sheet, which is the part that we probably understand the best because it starts from an interglacial climate, which we know very well, and, you know, we know what the cloudiness is and the humidity and things like that, and so all we have to do is save the snow. But you're right. I agree with you that it's sort of a, I mean, it's not a mechanistic model. It's, yeah. it's sort of a hand wavy kind of a thing.
Because you can see how the shape would increase the amount of light being reflected back into space.
Right.
Yeah. It's a ball planet, but I don't see the mechanism whereby you get back from that ice sheet to a nice warm balmy planet.
Well, in the real world, when it happens, you know, the last time, you know, 20 to 10,000 years ago, it happened in ways that we're still trying to figure out. So, you know, the model is going to answer all of the questions. So, Didier Payère, the author of this model, sort of spruced it up by putting in some simple growth kinetics for the ice sheet, and so he made the wiggles look like wiggles instead of square waves, you know, but it's basically the same thing. He gets the power spectrum better. He gets a dominant 100,000 year peak and no 400,000 year peak. The way he does that actually is by the 100,000 year cycle is actually sort of a multiple of the precessional cycle. So it's four or five precession times through the cycle. And that's sort of set by the kinetics of the ice sheet. So if you said that the ice sheet had to grow for a million years before it got big enough to melt down, you'd have a million year peak here. So it's a little bit sort of ad hoc, but it does capture the timings of the climate transitions fairly well. There's no doubt that when the northern hemisphere summer sunlight drops below a threshold, the ice volume goes up. So here's the northern hemisphere summer sunlight. Here's a threshold. And then wherever the sunlight is below that threshold, I put little red squares on this ice volume curve. And, you know, without fail, when it's cold in the northern hemisphere summer, the ice sheets grow. So Payère says that the 100,000 year cycle arises from the one-way streak of the ice sheet life cycle, sort of the peculiarities of the way ice sheets, or perhaps even just the Laurentide ice sheet, grows and dies. We can definitely see that ice volume responds to the northern hemisphere summer sunshine. The definite link with nucleating an ice sheet, going from a glacial or an interglacial to a glacial state. I mean, when you start to look at the details of it, it's not so clear. But what I'm going to do is use this critical insulation threshold, and that's what I'm going to put together with the long lifetime of CO2. So this is the trigger. If the insulation, when you're in an interglacial state, the sunlight in the northern hemisphere summer drops below the trigger value, that's the part that we're going to be looking at here. Maybe it's like sausage. You didn't want to see what goes into that. It would have been better if you started from that. So this is a result from a climate model. This is called it's called a model of intermediate complexity. So it's designed as opposed to the ones that they really forecast climate with or forecast weather with. You can run this model for 100 years in 10 minutes on a workstation instead of for running it for a year or something like that, because it has just a two-dimensional atmosphere and slab two-dimensional oceans. I mean, you have to cut things fairly ruthlessly if you want to do climate simulations on geologic sort of timescales. But what we did here was we slowly changed the orbit of the Earth so that the northern hemisphere summer sunlight intensity slowly dropped, and then all of a sudden, boom, it nucleates an ice sheet. So this is sort of the trigger right there. And then there's some hysteresis. You keep cooling and there's ice. And then if you warm past that trigger because the ice is reflecting the sunlight, it sort of stabilizes its own existence, that it stays cool, and it doesn't melt until you get to a warmer northern hemisphere sunlight input. So we can, and the value of this trigger that we get out of this model is very consistent with the trigger that is diagnosed from Paillard's model, from looking at the ice volume data going in the past. Now, to some extent, when you make any model, but in particular one of these very, very simplified models, there's a lot of tuning that has to go on. So I wouldn't say that the fact that we get the trigger right means that the model is intrinsically correct. It just means that it's not mal-tuned. So setting the stage here, the top panel is the CO2 in the atmosphere. We have these glacial, interglacial cycles of CO2 that you might have seen in Al Gore's movie or something, but they look kind of squished here because I put them on the same axis with the CO2 in the future from that long tail. So I've got three curves here. One is no emission, so that's saying let's turn off the glacial cycle sort of conceptually for a minute and not put any CO2 in. The largest one is 5,000 gigatons of carbon. That's basically equal to all of the coal. So we burned about 300 gigatons of carbon already. The business as usual scenario to the year 2100 says about 1,600 gigatons by then. And like I say, all the coal, if we were to burn all the currently available coal, that would be about 5,000 gigatons of carbon. So that's sort of taken as a large burn. All right, so then the second panel here is the Northern Hemisphere summer insolation that we've seen before. And here is the trigger value going in the past, sort of running Paillard's model. These are the interglacial periods. And so down here we have the real ice volume in black, and then the green is Paillard's model ice volume. Now from the intermediate complexity model, we can do a calculation to see how the change in the CO2 concentration in the atmosphere can change the value of this trigger. So going from an interglacial to a glacial state always happens when the CO2 is at sort of a natural interglacial level, like it was for us back in the year 1750 or so. But now the CO2 is higher than natural, so by altering the CO2, we're altering this trigger. And here is what the model results look like. As the CO2 rises from a natural 280 here to higher values, it takes a deeper trigger to nucleate the ice sheet. And that makes sense because, the CO2 is warming and the cool sun is cooling. You can compare them in terms of watts per meter squared of energy at the Earth's surface. It turns out that 1 watt per meter squared of CO2 is equivalent to about 4 watts per meter squared of the orbital forcing. And that's because the orbital forcing just redistributes the energy around the Earth and around the annual cycle. So if it's cold here, it's warm over there, and you might be able to sneak some of that heat in or save it or something like that, whereas CO2 is global. So a watt per meter squared of CO2 has more oomph than a watt per meter squared of the summertime sunlight at 65 north. So we take the long tail, and we run it through that last function I showed you, and this is what happens to that trigger. It goes, way down low. You can see that actually it's way off scale. This is in units of standard deviations of the long-term mean of the solar forcing, and you see that we exceed 3, 4, 5 standard deviations. There's no way that we're gonna, if we were to burn all that CO2, that we could possibly go into an ice age anytime in the future, in the near-term future. And then compounding off this is the fact that the Earth is nearly circular now, and so the variance of the orbital forcing in the next 50,000 years or so is already going to be smaller than it would have been than it is sort of in the long term average. So what you can see here, the sunlight intensity is just This is today. It's just now dropping and to where it's sort of grazing against Pallier's critical threshold, to where, you know, the next ice age might have started in 1,000 years or a couple thousand years. But really, it's too close to call. It's not, this insulation threshold isn't, you know, a fundamental constant in physics. It's just sort of a fuzzy number diagnosed from the geologic record, and it has a lot of uncertainty to it. So there's all kinds of passionate arguments in the geophysical literature about whether the next ice age, you know, was imminent or not, and I think it's too close to call. But assuming that we miss this one, because there's not much variation in the orbit in the next 50,000 years or so, the next opportunity that we would have would be about 50,000 years from now, and you see it's fairly, even that one is a fairly mild one, so even with a moderate CO2 emission of 1,000 gigatons or so, we could skip that one. And it could be that we could keep the interglacial, the current interglacial going, for a 500,000 years or more. We can sort of put off triggering this thing until the end of not this eccentricity minimum, but the next one, 400,000 years in the future. So this bottom part here is basically a sort of a crude temperature estimate. So we say that the temperature of the Earth scales by 6 degrees C between an ice age and an interglacial climate. And this includes the CO2 variation that naturally goes with the ice ages. And then this is global warming. So here's the climate sensitivity. This term here is basically the number of doublings of CO2. And so here is the results of that. We see this, you know, extended warm period that goes, you know, for hundreds of thousands of years into the future. Now, where I live in Chicago during the last ice age, there used to be 2 miles of ice or whatever it was. It looked like the interior of Greenland. And so I certainly wouldn't want to argue that, you know, we should save the ice age or anything like that. That's too extreme even for me. But you can sort of, I guess the message I would take from it is that natural cooling is not, doesn't look to be strong enough to ameliorate human-induced warming in the distant future. And one, just very, very briefly, one way in which this plays out is in sea level. So looking in the geologic past, we can correlate changes in sea level with changes in global temperature. So here's today, sea level of zero, temperature change of zero. Here's the last glacial time, sea level was 120 meters lower, and temperature was maybe 6 degrees colder. And here are some times further back in the past when it was warmer. And, you know, there's a lot of complexity here, but there is also, you know, virtually just sort of connecting the dots. You see a covariation of 10 or 20 degrees C for every, 10 or 20 meters of sea level for every degree C or so of change on the long term. Now, the forecast for the coming century from IPCC says 3 degrees of temperature and only 1 meter of sea level rise. And that's because sea level rises, it responds slowly to changes in temperature. So these changes in the past had the benefit of, you know, thousands of years of time. Now, you could make the argument that those models that predict ice sheet flow are probably too sluggish and that you could probably see more than that in 100 years, but I'm not going to make that. Oops, not going to make that argument today. I'm just going to sort of say that historically, 3 degrees C of warming is a very big deal in terms of sea level, and you know, 50 meters of sea level, that's enough to flood the land that 10% of humanity is living on. So, in summary, I just put together these two ingredients. One is the long tail of the CO2. And then the other is this mechanism for nucleating an ice sheet based on an insulation trigger. And if you do that, I guess the bottom line is that humankind is sort of taking over the reins of the biosphere. We now have the capacity to sort of dwarf the natural forces of climate that are responsible for the ice ages in the recent past. So that's it. Thank you.
had a question about reorganization of ocean circulation. I mean, one of the reasons, the way I understand it anyway, is that the green, the Antarctic ice sheets are so stable because the ACC, right, the Antarctic Circumpolar Current, is this huge energetic current that kind of isolates that part of the world from everything else that, that happens on the rest of the globe. So, I mean, you know, you move that little red dot a long ways up, but I mean, if you look back over geological time, there are also large-scale reorganizations of the way the ocean current systems work, right?
Yeah, so, and there's also, there's a similar sort of isolating effect in a vortex in the atmosphere, so the air above Antarctica is the coldest. That's why you have an ozone hole in Antarctica in particular much more strongly than over the Arctic, because the geometry of, you know, the way things go down there. The part of the Antarctica that is of most concern is the West Antarctic ice sheet. It formed on, you know, land, but as it grew, the weight of the ice pressed the land down. So now the whole Antarctic ice sheet is grounded on rock, which is below sea level. So if you raise sea level by, you know, having Greenland melt down, or if you warm up the ocean or something like that, it's, and to make matters worse, it's deepest in the center, like if you push down, you know, on a membrane or something. So if you start melting around the edges, you could get increasingly unstable as you erode into where the ice is grounded more and more deeply. I hope I answered your question.
One of the factors not considered very much in climate change is the effect of dust in the atmosphere, which is increasing from a variety of sources. And it's very complicated because over the ocean it might result in cooling, whereas over the land it might result in a warming.
Yeah.
My question is, in your type of model, have you got any possibility of including the impact of dust and what your speculations might be, say, over the next few thousand years with the increase of dust concentration?
Well, dust is increasing now in large part because of land use changes and desertification. You get these huge plumes of dust off the Sahara. My understanding, so I don't do atmospheric radiation modeling myself. My understanding is that the impact of mineral dust like that is still kind of not clear. It's not as strong an influence as sulfate aerosols, which, you know, come from the sulfur, it comes from combustion of coal, makes these little particles, and those have a clear cooling effect, in particular if they change the cloud droplet distribution size. But mineral dust doesn't act as much, as my understanding, as a cloud particle nucleation site, and I don't think their scattering properties are as equivocally, you know, is easy to. I'm sort of hedging on your question here. I don't think dust is a huge player in the present day climate. The forecast for the coming century and the models that they use to try to test whether the climate forcing from CO2, those do take into account sulfate aerosols, but I haven't heard about dust as being a huge part of that story. Maybe the whole thing is wrong because of that, but I don't think so.
Well, a lot of people have been ignoring it, but there is, in fact, before 20 years ago, that was considered the primary driver of climate change. It was considerably the opposite direction.
Yeah.
Both anthropogenic and natural.
Maybe to add to this question, what other natural agents of climate change are being considered in the climate models that you hear in the media?
Well, the sun does vary in its intensity. So the temperature over the past 100 years, there was sort of warming in the 40s to 1940 or so, and then a period of cooling from about 1940 to 70, and then warming since then. And the only way you can get that sort of zigzag is by including the solar forcing, is my understanding. And then there's also some component of that.
More important than CO2, that the sun has some.
Well, here, let me show you.
Constant in its,
I have this plot to show tonight, actually.
Yeah,
there it was. So here is the temperature. So this is the observed temperature over the last century, and this is a climate model run with only natural forcing, or here is only with anthropogenic forcing, so that's CO2 plus aerosols. And so you could hear the criticism, well, they missed this cooling here, but when you put both of them together, you could get this zigzag fairly well. And then the forcings are here. You see the solar forcing is sort of not terribly large, and it has a sort of a long sort of century time scale. This is diagnosed from cosmogenic isotopes in ice cores. So if the sun is powerful, it deflects cosmic rays, and so you don't get as much C14 and beryllium 10 deposition in ice cores. Volcanoes influence climate so these are all on the same vertical scale. Watts per meter squared is always that. So a volcano is a huge impact, but it's very short-lived. Here are aerosols, sulfate aerosols, and then here's greenhouse gases. And there's nothing in here that can give you the recent uptick in temperature like the greenhouse gases can. So that's sort of where the smoking gun is thought to be.
Still related to other causes, can you also comment on the methane hydrates in the oceans?
Yeah.
And there's this some evidence that if you reach some threshold in the temperature, then those will start to melt, and that's even a stronger greenhouse gas.
Yeah, methane, because methane is lower concentration in the atmosphere than CO2, the bands where the methane absorbs are less perturbed, and so a molecule of methane is worth 23 molecules of CO2, something like that. So there's actually as much methane frozen into these hydrate deposits as all of the coal. I told you that coal is the real monster fossil fuel, 5,000 gigatons of it. Well, there's about a comparable amount of this methane at the bottom of the ocean. So all the models of what happens to that with climate change say that the effect of that methane will probably be small over the coming century, because it takes a long time to warm up the waters at that depth in the ocean. And then the hydrate is located hundreds of meters below the seafloor, so you have to diffuse the heat down into there too. So that's got time constants of thousands of years. And if you actually put together a model of the hydrates over geologic time, there's a possibility for a sort of instability. So some hydrate melts and it releases carbon, which turns into, it's methane for a decade or so, but then it turns into CO2 on timescales that can actually warm up the deep ocean. So the CO2 warms up the deep ocean, more methane melts, and you get a runaway effect. So we calculated that if the hydrates were unstable enough that they would melt, with a time constant of 1,000 years, all of them, say, for example, then the system would be unstable even without fossil fuel CO2. It would just melt down every so often, every couple million years anyway. There's not evidence for that, so there's room to hope that this stuff, even though it seems intrinsically unstable, this methane hydrate would not be stable any place at the Earth's surface because the pressure isn't high enough. And it wants to float. It floats like regular ice. It's only held down there because there's mud on top of it. And so, and there's so much methane that if 10% of this stuff got out, it'd be like increasing the PCO2 of the atmosphere by a factor of 10. It would just be apocalyptic. And so it just sounds really scary. But when you look at it in detail, nobody's come up with a mechanism by which it would all come out all at once. Probably more likely is you'd get, and also from melting permafrosts, you might get an increase in a sort of year-in, year-out chronic source of methane to the atmosphere that might raise the methane concentration of the atmosphere. Because it's a transient, it comes in at some rate, and then it reaches a steady state where it degrades as quickly as you're adding it at some concentration. So if you were to add it at a faster rate, the concentration in steady state could go up.
Yeah. So can you give any specific examples of really bad things that could happen if we prolong the next ice age for an unusual long?
The next interglacial?
Yeah. Or,
yeah. Well, I mean, yes, we were talking about this at lunch. None of this has any practical implication for any of us because we're not going to live for 100,000 years. So, you know, why should we care at all? I sort of approach that as kind of a curiosity. I think the potential for bad things in the coming century, I sort of worry about drought. There was during the medieval warm time, which was sort of the last time that the Earth was sort of at a climate comparable to today, there were these extended, like 25-year-long droughts in the American and Mexican sort of Southwest that you know, spelled the end of the Mayan and the Anasazi civilizations. And they call them mega droughts. If it lasts more than a couple of years, you know, the aquifers run down, the crops die, the soils change their character, they lose the ability to hold water. You know, you get locked into this sort of state. So that's the kind of thing that I worry about for the coming century. In terms of the, you know, what happens 10,000 years from now, you know, I guess I sort of draw the analogy to nuclear waste, that we don't have any practical reason to care about making nuclear waste that's going to last for 10,000 years either, because we're not going to be around for that 10,000 years. But everybody seems to know about that, and it seems to matter to people, even though there's no practical reason to. And I find myself, when I fill up my gas tank, thinking, God, 100,000 years just for a trip to Target. You know, I can't explain why it should make any difference, because on a practical level, it doesn't, you know, it clearly doesn't. But there it is.
So this might be a bit related to what you were just talking about. Just wondering, there are a lot of other climate cycles apart from like ice ages.
Yeah.
Are there any other movable triggers? Like these smaller short-term cycles? Can the way they are triggered or the way they go and change?
So there were these sort of 1,500-year cycles during the last ice age. Actually, not in the glacial maximum, the coldest of the cold, and not during the interglacial time, which is the warmest of the warm, but sort of as the climate is drifting down in this sawtooth pattern through the sort of intermediate times, there was this instability that centered around the North Atlantic, involved changes in sea ice and ocean circulation and temperature, and had huge impact on the temperatures in Greenland where they were recording the ice core. And then the germ of, you know, that was sort of the germ of truth in that movie, The Day After Tomorrow, that you hopefully didn't see a couple of years ago. So, you know, I guess we're just getting, people who study those are just getting to the point where they can begin to assemble the list of ingredients that must have been, you know, part of it. We can't really explain them mechanistically. Certainly couldn't forecast them. I think that worrying about, you know, the exact same thing happening in the future with global warming. Okay, so the idea is that, well, there were some of these events that were triggered by fresh water running off the land into the ocean. So one called the Younger Dryas lasted 1,000 years after apparently the transition to the glacial, to the interglacial climate had happened. So everything warmed up. It's like today for 1,000 years, and all of a sudden, bam, you're back into a glacial climate for another 1,000 years, and then it comes back. And that's been correlated to the release of a bunch of fresh water that was dammed in by the Laurentide ice sheet. So it used to drain down to the Gulf of Mexico, and then suddenly it could get out to the North Atlantic, and all this fresh water stopped this overturning circulation that carries all the heat to the Northern Hemisphere. So the concern for the future is maybe the freshwater source would be Greenland melting instead of this big lake running off. You shut down this overturning circulation. Say you did it, you know, catastrophically, could that launch Northern Europe into sort of some new cold state? I guess the way most people are now thinking that by the time that happens, the warming would already be enough to swamp any local cooling. And I sort of have the feeling that it's like, you know, the generals in the army always planning for the last war. You know, we're sort of struggling to explain what happened then. There's no way we could have forecast it, you know, from the outset. And what could happen in the future, there's also no way really to forecast because, you know, we're just not that good.
Well, that kind of pulls our LP, which is the...